Pleasure to have you with us for our last of our IBRI colloquia for spring of 1984. This evening we're pleased to have with us Dr. Douglas S. Chin. Dr. Chin is Assistant Professor of Physics at Ursinus College. Received his PhD from Cornell University in Geophysics, speaking to us on the subject, earthquakes, are they increasing?
Basically what I want to outline tonight as introductory material is exactly what earthquakes are, and to go through that, and then we'll discuss one verse in Scripture, all right? Only Matthew 24. That's the only verse we're going to discuss tonight. Somehow, a religious talk, feel like I should bring more Scripture in, but only one that seems to be significant. But we'll go through that. So I hope you all have my sheets here. I basically want to answer seven questions today. The first thing is, what is an earthquake? Now, what happens in an earthquake is that you have two pieces of land, and they essentially move, right? Sometimes they move, one piece moves sideways, and the other, you know, moves sideways like that. Sometimes one piece moves up and down. Sometimes they slide like this under each other. And sometimes, on a more rare scale, it opens up. I know that usually what people are most used to earthquakes is that you're being swallowed up, where the earth actually goes like that, opens up, and everybody falls in, and then it closes back again. That, I think, rarely happens. I think that there are only two known cases where somebody's been swallowed up in an earthquake. Those are the most rare types. I think there is one person who's known to have been killed in one cow. And that's all, as far as swallowing it up. I think that comes from the biblical passage where certain people of Israel, the ground opened up, swallowed them up, and they think that that's their idea of an earthquake. But usually that's not what happens. Furthermore, most of this moving of the earth back and forth usually occurs way underground. And you only feel the shaking on top, so that, you know, any possibility of you being let's say, split in half if the earth moves sideways or thrown up off your feet, are rare, all right? Usually down inside the ground, 10, 20 kilometers, 30 kilometers down inside the ground is usually a place where the earthquake occurs. Now, the reason why these things occur is because there are different stresses building up in the earth, all right? Pushes and pulls, and once in a while, depending on where you are, the pressure builds up and the earth cracks beneath the surface and you get an earthquake. So when you get two sides of things moving, it produces a lot of shaking and it sends out what you call seismic waves. Now, how does an earthquake differ from a nuclear explosion? Earthquakes mainly move sideways. Nuclear explosion is like blowing up a balloon where the thing blows outwards. So that for a nuclear explosion, it's very symmetric, pushing outward, while the earthquake can think of as sideways shaking. How do we detect and locate earthquakes? When earthquakes occur, they send out waves in the earth, and the bottom half of the slide shows what we call seismograms. And you notice that there are two squiggles. You can see the two curved lines there. Earthquakes send out two types of waves. Well, there are more than two types of waves, but the two primary waves are what they call compressional and shear waves. And you get two distinctive squiggles depending where you are. All right, we have seismographs on the surface of the earth, which essentially measures the ground motion. And when an earthquake occurs, it sends out waves in the earth, and the seismographs measure these waves. And so you get two arrivals. Depending where you are, there's a time difference between when you get the first arrival and the second arrival, and that tells you approximately how far away you are from the earthquake. So, once you know how far away you are, what you do is you send your information to a central office that collates everyone. They calculate how far you are away from the earthquake, how far everyone else is away from the earthquake, and by a process called triangulation, you find out approximately where the earthquake occurred. That's how we find out where earthquakes are located. Going back to the top slide there, you want to ask yourselves where earthquakes occur. Now, basically, as far as earthquakes occurring, there's this theory about the Earth called plate tectonics. The theory essentially says that the surface of the Earth consists of a bunch of plates which move, so that you have a whole section, let's say one piece of plate, and in the interior of the plate is mainly stable. All right, it's only where that plate touches another plate and where they rub together that you get earthquakes. They occur in the middle of oceans. They occur mainly where there are mountains. That one of the theories of mountain builds up is that you have two plates coming together, and due to the compressive nature of two plates coming together, you get mountain building, heating of the earth, volcanism, etc. For example, like on the west coast of South America, there's a mountain range there. There's also an ocean trench there. The ocean trench saying that part of the seafloor is being pushed underneath the continent of South America, forming a trench, and as well as producing a mountain chain, producing volcanism, and producing earthquakes. So that's the general idea, which explains where most of the earthquakes occur. Here are the places where earthquakes mainly occur. You can see that they occur on the western coast of South America, the western coast of the United States, and Alaska, Japan, in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, and then you can see some in China as well as in Europe. So those are the general places where earthquake activity occurs today. And basically where you see the dense number of earthquakes are where the plate margins are. Right, so there's a plate margin along the western coast of South America, around the Pacific. There's another plate margin in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. I would say for almost all the earthquakes that occur, generally occur, that they occur on those places. But remember, these plates are under stress in the middle. And while, let's say, earthquakes in the central part of the United States, now that's the interior of a plate, while they're more rare, that earthquakes occur once in a while. But the Earth center of the United States is not a plate margin, so that they occur rarely, but at plate margins they occur frequently. Since every place of a plate is under stress, in theory it is possible to have an earthquake any place in the world. That would not be an unusual occurrence. You would not be able to say that it is impossible to have an earthquake, let's say here in Hatfield, even though there have been no known earthquakes, as far as I can tell, in Hatfield. There's been some in Philadelphia, but where I went to school in Ithaca, there are no known earthquakes ever, not even, you know, nearby. But in principle, there could be an earthquake. There could be a large earthquake. All you could say is that the stress is building up beneath you, and you're not quite sure what will happen, and there may be an earthquake one day. Now I want to answer the question, how do we measure the size of an earthquake? Usually you hear things on the radio which talk about the Richter scale. The Richter scale is what we call a logarithmic scale of an earthquake. Basically, the way you calculate the Richter magnitude is that first you know the distance from where you are from the earthquake. You're 100 miles, 200 miles. And then you ask yourself, how big are the waves on my seismograph? Right, obviously, the closer you are, the bigger the waves are, and as you move out, the waves get smaller. But of course, there's some scaling factor that if it's a large earthquake, you're obviously going to get larger waves. And so, due to some process like that, you assign the earthquake a magnitude, a Richter magnitude, which determines the size. And in general, the Richter magnitudes only range between, let's say, 4 to 8. 4 is a very small earthquake. The atomic bombs that were dropped on Japan would measure about 4, meaning in 4 in energy, if there were seismographs around. What we call great earthquakes are magnitude 8. And there seems to be a reason that there are no earthquakes that are greater than magnitude 8, mainly because that seems to represent the stress limit of the Earth. You just can't build up any more stress on the Earth above a magnitude 8 earthquake. So generally, magnitude 4s are felt. You feel those, but they don't do much damage. Magnitude 5s, they do slight damage. 6s, moderate damage. 7s, severe damage. And 8s, you know, a lot of damage. One of the most famous earthquakes was the earthquake in 1906 in San Francisco. And essentially, now that one, the Earth moved sideways and it actually broke the surface, where you measure two poles that were like fences that were together, you measure them, they're like 24 feet, you know, difference. But that was a really great earthquake. So you had 1 foot on one side and another foot on the other side, it would have ripped you in half, all right. Ripped a few houses in half, too. Those are for great earthquakes. As far as the United States goes, California is on the western side of the United States. That is an earthquake zone. There's a plate boundary there. We expect recurring earthquakes there, large earthquakes. In fact, what people talk about is not will there be a great earthquake in California. It's asking, you know, when is it going to be? All right, now over here in the eastern part of the United States, you might ask yourself, will we ever have a large earthquake or not? You know, it's possible, maybe, maybe not. But you see over there, they ask themselves, when are we going to have it? But of course, over here in the eastern United States, we've had large earthquakes. There's a large earthquake in Charleston, South Carolina, back in the 1800s, and there's a whole series of large earthquakes in Missouri, southeastern Missouri. So we're not immune from that. As far as we're concerned out here in the east, you know, an earthquake's a big deal because they occur so rarely. But also, there seems to be something that earthquakes waves travel more efficiently in the eastern half of the United States. If you have a small earthquake, you can feel the vibrations from a very large distance away. Out in California, there seems to be a lot of damping of earthquake waves. The earthquake waves just damp out, so that's just one of those things. And it's a factor of like 10 to 1, all right? If you were 10 miles from an earthquake, you would feel the same as if you're 100 miles, okay, out in the east. It's one of those things. But the earthquakes in the east are generally much smaller, much rarer. Now I want to address myself to what are what we call major earthquakes or significant earthquakes. Generally, the larger the earthquake, obviously, the more major it is. Major and significant is really defined in terms of how does it affect people in general. Large earthquakes obviously affect people. But small earthquakes, you know, depending on whether it's near a population center or not, may or may not be significant. If a small earthquake occurs under your house and knocks your house over, you know, to you it's significant. To everybody else, you know, it's who cares. And so generally, what we call significant earthquakes are those ones that are really large, or the smaller ones that occur near population centers and that do some damage, take some lives, or knock over some buildings. All right, that's what we call significant earthquakes. I've made a chart for you here showing you, at least from 72 to 82, the approximate number of significant earthquakes. Another way to measure the number of significant earthquakes is how many people have gotten killed in that. You can see that in 1556, an estimate of 830,000 people got killed in this one earthquake in China. There was another one in China in 1976, which they estimated that occurred in a major population center in eastern China. They estimated that 500,000 people got killed in that. Now, one reason why there's a question mark there is that the communist Chinese authorities don't let Western newspaper people in to investigate how many people died, and they won't give you any casualty figures, except that obviously we picked up that earthquake on our seismographs, knew it was a really large earthquake, knew it was in a population center, and they just tried to estimate that. And one of the funny things about, you see, measuring earthquakes, significant earthquakes in terms of lives lost, is that generally about 10% of the earthquakes occur in the Middle East, in Turkey, in Iran, places like that. But about 90% of the earthquake casualties occur there. And it's basically, the primary reason is that for that is their housing construction. Usually in the Middle East, they have really these heavy roofs on top of these houses, and so the roof is really heavy compared to the rest of the house. When the house collapsed, the roof would cave in on you, and that's that. In other places in the world where they have different types of construction or better construction, that you can have a really large earthquake and, you know, not too many people get killed. Like out in California, there have been some significant earthquakes, but because of their better building construction, et cetera, that, hardly anyone in the United States ever gets killed because of an earthquake. All right. If you had a different type of housing construction, it'd be significantly different. And that's the basic definition, significant earthquake. Now, what I want to ask ourselves, are earthquakes increasing? There's this one verse in Matthew 24:7, where Jesus says that at the end times, there will be earthquakes. All right. That's about all it says. Now, generally, the interpretation of that verse has been that there must be an increase in the number of earthquakes. The reason being is that earthquakes have always occurred throughout human history. They've occurred practically everywhere, all right, at some time or another. And to say that there will be earthquakes, you know, what kind of sign is that? You know, there will be people, okay, or there will be tornadoes, or there will be floods or things like that. Now, those things always happen. So generally, people who take this verse as a prophetic sign have generally understood this to mean that there will be a great increase in the number of earthquakes from a particular background level. You have 10, 20, 50 large earthquakes per year, that you take some average over your period of time, and all of a sudden it jumps to 200 per year. All right, that would be a significant sign. Versus the other way that, well, I mean, there will be earthquakes because I'll know about them more. Okay, one occurred out here in Lancaster County, rare event. That doesn't mean that, you know, because of those people, they never heard of earthquakes before, that that's necessarily a sign of the end times because they, you know, an earthquake. Okay. All right. So generally, that's the way the prophetic verse is understood. And so on this graph I have here, this is just a section of the United States showing where large earthquakes have occurred. So if you're out in Texas somewhere, it's not too likely, at least from past earthquake data, that we get a large earthquake. The bottom half of the slide shows you the San Andreas Fault near the place where it broke in 1906 south of San Francisco. You can see that the place is really built up now. One of the reasons why we've been hearing more of earthquakes is because people have been moving into places where there are earthquakes. About, let's say, 20, 30 years ago, you saw the same picture, but there would be zero houses on that. It would be barren land, okay? And so that if an earthquake occurred there, we would say, so what? You know, didn't do anyone damage. Now, because of the increased population, if an earthquake occurred there, there would be significant damage and loss of life. All right, I have this chart here. This is a chart put out by the National Earthquake Information Service. Shows the number of earthquakes from 72 to 82. And you can see that, let's say about 75, there seems to be a slight jump from a background about 25 to, let's say, about 50, 60, somewhere in there. 1976 was a really large number of significant earthquakes, and then they 77 had dipped, and it's been fluctuating about 60, 65, somewhere in there. Now, as far as the statistics on last year goes, the headlines as far as EOS goes says more quakes, fewer deaths. that there were about, instead of 60 significant earthquakes, there are about 70, but there are much fewer earthquake-related deaths. And so those are the statistics. And so now we want to ask ourselves is, are earthquakes really increasing or not? Or are they just fluctuating? Seems to me that as far as the statistics go, that it's too early for us to claim that the number of significant earthquakes are on the rise. I think one of the problems that we see is like now with better news media and things like that, like the earthquakes out in Lancaster County, yeah, they made news here, but as far as a geologist was concerned, it was like, yeah, it rattled a few houses. I didn't hear of any damage reports that anything significant besides, you know, a few walls cracking maybe. But to us, you know, perhaps it seems like, yeah, earthquakes are increasing. But as far as the number of significant earthquakes on a worldwide scale, it appears not. And one of the problems is that why on this particular graph is there no data before 72? Well, one reason is that during the late 1960s, the United States put up this what was called the Worldwide Network of Standardized Seismographs. Basically, it was in response to the Nuclear Test Ban Treaty to try to put seismographs on various parts of the world to see if the Russians were cheating on you, blowing up nuclear explosions above a certain megatonnage. Well, earthquakes also are detected by these seismographs. And so basically, before then, you weren't quite sure where all the, let's say, smaller earthquakes in the world occurred. They may have occurred in remote places, but you wouldn't know about it because you didn't have the equipment to detect it. It may have occurred in certain places that were far away from civilization, or it may have occurred in places where mass communication was not available or in a place in the world where we don't care. And so the seismologist might know about it, but it's not going to make the national news. So really, I would say that before 72, our handle on the number of significant earthquakes, let's say, tenuous. It's difficult to say that what the background level was. Now, I have to say in one thing that the number of significant earthquakes has been increasing in the sense that people have been moving into earthquake areas. Yes, earthquakes are increasing in that sense. Population expands, you move into places where you would normally not live in. They're increasing in that sense, but as far as general number, or as far as the number of, let's say, very large earthquakes, the number of magnitude 7 and 8 earthquakes, I would say that no, that they're not increasing on that aspect. And so I really get annoyed when I watch some of these films and people start saying that earthquakes have been increasing every year. Well, I would say that they're overstating the case, all right, that definitely the number of large earthquakes, magnitude 7s and 8s, haven't been increasing. If they mean that the number of earthquakes have been increasing because we notice them more or they make national news more, I would say, yeah, maybe so. But I don't think that that's the, let's say, proper interpretation of that prophetic verse. That if, let's say, in 85, the number of significant earthquakes went up to, let's say, double this to 160, 200, something like that, then I'd say, yeah, that might be the fulfillment of this verse and stayed there. Okay, but if not, I don't think so. So, any questions?
Was the smallest earthquake detected, say, in a seismograph anywhere on Earth? In other words, if the earthquake was anywhere on Earth, it would be detected by, say, a standard seismograph?
I would say about a magnitude 4.
Above.
You can detect anywhere.
Any seismograph will detect.
Well, not any. No, the network will.
Okay,
the network
will. Because I'm trying to figure out something that would be, in other words, how good our system would be back before the network was deployed. What the smallest earthquake can be detected from a given site that would be anywhere on Earth.
Well, you see, there's a problem in that. I would say definitely a 7s or 8s. Yeah, I think so. But as far as, let's say, 6s and 5s, depending where they are, you have to remember that back in the old days, the seismographs were of varied quality, definitely lower magnification. And so that, but I would say sevens and eights would be a good.
So in principle, statistics for sevens and eights should be good back to what the turn of the century is.
Right. Turn of the century. So that's about when seismology came there, came into being. And you have to remember that seismology, as far as those large earthquakes go, you know, in Western Europe and the United States, pretty good statistics. On the other side of the world.
I know you don't want to discuss this again, but
sure.
The first, you know, it says sands and earthquakes in various places. It doesn't say whether they're on Crete. I guess that's
right.
Kind of insinuated.
Sure.
But the next verse says all these are the beginning of growth pains.
Mm-hmm.
And in looking at the graph, I would think that the graph has to show double.
Okay.
To be significant, my question is, if we see a, like obviously through 72 to 74, it's all small, and then you see this gradual small progression, would that, if it continued the way it was, up and down, gradually getting more and more, would that be statistically significant in your opinion?
I would say, yeah, it depends if you can see a trend like that. But I would say that after 10 years, you know, that's difficult to see a trend. And if you want to notice, too, that for 72, 73, and 74, that the primary increase seems to be in the small number of earthquakes, right, that are detected, or that, let's say, the population expanded, et cetera. These, now, I'm not quite sure which earthquakes these refer to, but suppose that the ones in black, the small number of earthquakes are places on the other side of the world. Okay, then you have no idea, you know, that in 72, 73, 74, those are the ones that we only knew about it, but they really occurred over there. And so it's really our knowledge that's making the number of earthquakes increase and not an actual.
So are you saying the graph is not?
I'm saying that before, let's say before, definitely before 72, that your statistics, especially for the small earthquakes, are not reliable.
Okay.
And so how could you, you know, if you're going to say trying to find a trend.
Obviously, you need another 10 years.
Or something, right.
The trend going. But I just wondered, in your opinion, you seem to think you want to double.
I was just suggesting that as, if it doubled there, I'd say, yeah, that would be significant. All right, yeah, if it went up slowly, okay, too, but.
That's not really what the verse says.
No, that, right. Okay, it just says that there will be in the earthquakes, but, you know, they're all right, but you have to do something that there have always been earthquakes, right?
I have another question about faults. Are faults the things you were talking about that if you give a haplo that's small, that they know that there's a weakening there, and that's where it will most likely occur?
Right, you can, there are, yes, between two things move and a fault is the crack between them. Usually they move, all right, but just because there's a fault doesn't mean that there's going to be an earthquake, all right, or that there has necessarily been an earthquake there. There could be slow movement.
When that earthquake occurred in Lancaster, you know, they got on the news and
right.
Everything, and they said there was a fault around here and so forth. Is the chance when the earthquake occurs, is the chance of the it occurring greater in an area where there is a fault right around it, or somewhere in the blue there?
Let's say, I would say a major fault where earthquakes have been known to occur on that in the past. But if you just see a fault that an earthquake would occur there that hasn't had a previous history, I'd say it's not that great.
Just like there are major faults run along the coast.
Yes.
However, they stabilize themselves over a long period of time. One is the Logan Fault between two faults in parallel on the coast.
Mm-hmm.
There's another one that seems to crop up in the last couple of years. One of comes in off the continental shelf and goes toward Cornwall, Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm.
The one around Lancaster could have been another case altogether. Lancaster has been undermined by limestone. Limestone has tended to dissolve. new springs outside of Redmond. It's really quickly to be dolling the limestone as well, and the entire area. So it's a local thing, but it is an earthquake.
Would you call that a settling? Is the same thing as an earthquake? Well, they picked it up in Colorado. So.
Well, yeah, but that was, let's say that was a small earthquake. Okay, one of the things that we always picked up were in Ithaca were mine blasts from the Tamaqua mines. Okay, you can pick those things up too. I mean, they're small. I guess technically they're not an earthquake, but you know, from a seismograph, you can't tell a difference of that, except that it always occurred near the end of the day, regularly. Okay, that's how I knew that it was not a small earthquake, that it was from a mine blast, because it occurred almost, I think, 3:45 every day, or practically every day when they're about to quit. Okay.
Yeah. I also wanted to comment that if you go out on the San Andreas Fault, at one particular spot that I know of, they have a seismograph, and that thing is moving constantly. You don't necessarily see what you're standing there, but you're watching you, like you're signaling like this all the time, 24 hours a day. Sometimes it was stronger than others. That
it's
insignificant, but I'm sure. Here, this whole thing is moving under me. I don't even realize it.
Right.
You go to a place in South America, I know in Ecuador, they have a spot there that I know that they have over an average of over 30 earthquakes a month.
Mm-hmm.
Now, whether it's because of the poverty there or whether it's because of the condition, because none of the buildings are above one or two stories.
Well, a lot of the jiggling that you see on the seismographs, a lot of it's due to weather, alright? When the weather, when you have a storm, it will shake the land, and the wind and the ocean hitting the sides of the, you know, the coast will produce waves that are, you know, that will appear on seismographs. That's one of the reasons why it jiggles all the time, not necessarily because they're small earthquakes.
I don't know what it's doing because of new buildings. I did my work. If they had a shaft well down below them, that's where it would be interfered with by surface vibration, mm-hmm. Well down in the bedrock, some several hundred feet down below them, 30 fault and warming.
Well, right. In Ithaca, where there was little, let's say, truck activity, our seismographs were in the basement on the foundation of the building. All right. If you're in Philadelphia and the trucks are going by all the time, you would have to do something else.
I have it on a shaft that's about 100 something.
Sure.
We know the number of long-term variations in the earth. While events associated with the changes, long-term changes in magnetic fields and all that, it seems to me that 10 years is really very premature to say that there's any kind of regular earthquake here.
Sure. Definitely, you can't say anything for the small earthquakes. The black magnitude 4 to 4.6.4. You definitely can't say anything. And for the other ones, you know, your statistics maybe go back to the 1920s, somewhere around there. That's 1900 maybe, as far as statistics go. Obviously, you know, from the historical record, as I didn't do a plot on this one of how many people got killed on the earthquake, well, except for the one in China in 76, seems like the number of earthquake deaths have been going down due to better construction. But then you say, well, maybe the one in 76, if you average it all out, it made up for it in earthquakes.
I think I poorly magnetic field. Magnetic field changes its value year to year. But generally, there's a downward trend.
Uh-huh.
That you know after, of course, even a few thousand years, it changes.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if this is the same type of thing here. I
mean, don't know. Don't have enough data.
But I think we have precedent to say, let's be careful, as you are, just because it's increased even by a factor of two, this may be totally insignificant for the long term.
Right. So. That's just the name of the magazine, EOS.
Right. It doesn't have that's not an acronym or something?
I don't think so.
Oh, okay. It's a Greek goddess, I think.
Oh, okay. It's a earthquake observation. Okay, my second question is, I live in Santa Monica, really.
Oh.
Is there data that makes this kind of extension throughout the world, or is there...
No, I think that you mean about the earthquake deaths?
Yeah.
Well, you said 10% of the earthquakes occur in the Middle East, and much higher percentage of casualties.
Right.
My point is, Matthew picks on two things which are clearly associated in minds of diseases and issues or whatever.
Okay.
So horrible destruction and death. Famine, obviously, had a known phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe if there are that many earthquakes going on, people would invest more in destruction and death than they could do. And therefore, he has just picked two particular signs, which, they would know then and they'll know again.
So you think that you're saying that maybe Matthew applies only to the region around Israel? Or?
No, I'm just saying, probably take it that way. Maybe this isn't something you should look for as an increase ever in the United States, because famines are there, and both of those things are just going to be, maybe the same thing model. But they're representative of something that people would know as being a horrible destructive force. And therefore, do we need to look for an increase? I'm agreeing.
Okay,
fine. I'm just looking from an interpretive standpoint.
Maybe they're talking at the time of the tribulation, there's supposed to be a very great earthquake. That's still a sign, in a sense, like those things will occur before Christ return, at least according to the Tribune of Deal and all.
They were at the beginning of the first time, so that kind of isn't the beginning. But I think that all the way to the couple of numbers, the same reason for Christians in every generation to feel like that, that they were invited, and that this was, that things were still rewarding the world in that sense. The constant experience, which is still our experience, and I know that Christians in many generations before World War II, I think if I had been there, I could have easily said that things were, coming to some point.
But would you feel that way only because, in your lifetime some cataclysmic event happens? Other people in the past, those types of cataclysmic events have happened. Right. But on a global scale, you would say that
in the first century, they felt that Christ was trying to the Lord, he said that, the time is no one knows but the Father, and that anticipation of his return, I think it's been something that's been precious to him all the way, that the Lord has allowed that things go on.
This particular location in Matthew 24 has some complications, I suppose. It looks like that Jesus is telling us that there are going to be lots of things coming. That's not the end of it. That's the mark of 6.
Mm-hmm.
And then the nation will rise against nation, king will be king, first place will be famine, earthquakes. Little thing will be the beginning of earth things. So that might be something to characterize the whole inter-advent period, in which case you're just saying there's going to be trouble. Okay? And there have been. You've had all these things. Okay? So it may be too strong to argue that increased earthquake is even expected at the end.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Certainly, in a couple of passages, a very large earthquake is mentioned. Presumably, whatever split the Mount of Olives in Zechariah 14, and the Revelation passage, an earthquake that destroys Jerusalem, as a matter of fact, in connection with the witnesses, what's that, Revelation 12? I suppose the trick is, what do you make at the beginning of birth pangs? The term birth pangs is used, I think, in rabbinic literature, or the events preceding the coming of Messiah, something of that sort. Are we just to take that as some kind of a figure meaning, bad before birth, but then there's a birth to do heaven, or whatever. Or are we to push it harder and say, birth pangs get worse and worse and closer again to birth? I think that's kind of
So what you're saying is that perhaps Matthew 24:7 does not have any, let's say, imminent prophetic significance versus just some general thing, and so that anyone who says, even looks for earthquakes increasing is...
Might be mistaken.
Yeah,
I wouldn't be dogmatic, frankly.
On the other hand, Messiah's come, you expect peace. And Jesus might be saying, it's not going to be a time of peace. You're still going to have famines, you're still going to have wars, you're still going to have earthquakes. Don't be surprised, because these things are going to take place, and they keep happening until the second time. the Messianic Age, the millennium has not started. It will start on the second one, but not on the first.
There's an interesting addition part of the Luke chapter, because it says, great earthquakes down in past forces, and therefore down some great signs from heaven. It seems that the great signs from heaven, both in Matthew and Luke, that's going to be really looked for. So that's going to be the difference there.
This isn't exactly about earthquakes, but it does tie in, and I don't know if this is significant or if you would care to comment on the expectations that have been voiced in the media about weather related changes with the last year we heard all year about the El Nino effect and then the greenhouse effect. Would that be have any effect on earthquakes? The melting and cooling down of the
That would probably not, since the earthquakes are mainly underground phenomena that anything on the surface has minimal effect on what happens underground. And since they're really deep, too, you know, some people talk about lubricating the San Andreas Fault, but, you know, that's most of the earthquake activity occurs down beneath. It seems hard to, or to relieve that much pressure, even though it's known that sometimes you start pumping stuff underground, you do cause earthquakes, but they're usually the small ones, all right, not the large ones.
These faults, when they these planes slide against each other, what's the area, the length that we're talking about? The St. Andrews fault has an earthquake. Is that going to extend over a mile or 100 miles? I mean,
well, the large ones can extend like 50, 60 miles. Okay, the magnitude 8, depending on, you know, the surface area and how wide it is and, you know, how long. The small ones, you know, maybe a few inches. Not quite sure because most of them occur underground. The ones that break the surface, the smaller ones, maybe they break like a foot, 2 feet, something like that. Like I said, the real large one in San Francisco, about 20. Okay, so.
I've read that the difference between the two numbers in the Richter scale is a factor of 10 in the energy. Is that what you refer to in the table in the energy nerd?
It's really about a factor of 30. So each point in the Richter scale is about a factor of 30.
And it's the Earth.
Right. So a magnitude 5 is 30 times, has 30 times the energy of magnitude 4.
How do you define energy?
It's really by the height of the waves that you get. If you're a certain distance, you measure the height of the waves, and that tells you.
You answered how far the fault actually moves. The fault moves 24 feet. But I thought you were asking how much of the fault could be involved in an earthquake. Would a mile of the fault, 100 miles, 1,000 miles of the fault actually be involved in the shift?
Well, I mean, it depends. You see, a breakage over a large, let's say, over 100 miles and only, let's say, moved an inch might be the same as something over really small that moved a lot. You see, so there's some trade-off. Well, it depends where you are. Okay, now most of the ones, let's say, here in Lancaster County or things like that, I would think that they were small, confined earthquakes on, moving very little. The ones like out in the San Andreas, those could break for, let's say, miles in just a little bit. And then the large ones break for miles and move a lot.
Sometimes slight movement along one of those large faults sets up stress on other parts.
Right.
Which in turn may not be simultaneous with the
mm-hmm.
But may take place in steps as the fault adjusts itself. There's another interesting comment that I want to make. The earthquake that had in Alaska a few years ago. I'm not sure all the details, but I know some of the most important fact is the soil cover was a clay material. It became fluid upon vibration.
Yes.
Those that are in civil engineering know that a lot of times clay become quite fluid if they're not stabilized. And the shaking set this clay layer in motion, and the whole thing became fluid and just slumped into the bed.
Yes.
So the surface was manifested on the surface, something that happened mm-hmm. deep below was shaking it, the upper layer.
Mm-hmm.
It was clay, it became fluid or liquid and slumped into the bed. but there was a surface manifestation caused by an underlying disturbance.
One of those, like with building construction, usually nowadays, that you can get the building to not, let's say, collapse on an earthquake. One problem is that having a decent foundation, and buildings in Japan are known to just flop over like that in one piece because it's built on, you know, a bad foundation, but it's structurally sound to, you know, resist an earthquake, but, you know, don't have the foundations like that. I guess one of the other things that are common with earthquakes is that you have this two plates going down like this. Right, so you have, let's say, the Andes Mountains on this side, and you have this plate going down, and you have the ocean on here. Now, what happens is that you've heard of, mainly called tidal waves here, it's usually called tsunamis, is that earthquakes generate tsunamis, that when you have an earthquake, essentially this part slips like that, goes like that, pushes the water across, and produces a tidal wave, a tsunami, that goes across the Pacific Ocean and floods the other side. All right. In fact, one of the things that some people try to do was to reconstruct the earthquake history of South America by going over to Japan and trying to find the history of their destruction by tsunamis, okay, a large earthquake.
Okay. I just heard on the news where yesterday they had one in Italy that killed a few people, and they said it was, I guess, in the middle of the night, and everybody runs down the street. And that's something we don't know because we live here. And I just, is that what you're supposed to do, run out of your house? Is that?
It depends what type of building you're in, okay? That if you're in a building that you think is going to collapse on you, yeah, it's better. Well, let's say you're out in your country estate where there's nothing around, and you feel like the beginnings of an earthquake are going to happen. Yeah, you'd go out into the field, fine. But if you're in a built-up area like San Francisco or Philadelphia where you're afraid that everything's going to collapse on you, you're probably just as safe inside than if you're, you know, outside in the street and the buildings are going to collapse on you.
Some of the details in the Alaskan earthquake, they say the ground was vibrating so violently that people were holding on to poles and things like that to keep them from jostling about and actually being thrown to the ground. But actually there was that much movement that they were holding on to telephone poles and on to something that was fixed so that they wouldn't be jostled about.
Right. So, I mean, earthquakes are very powerful things that we can think to knock over buildings.
I've heard that the people in China are more, are better able, at least they were proven to predict earthquakes than the other people, and that they have done it successfully in evacuated cities before an earthquake occurred there. Is that true, and how do they do it?
Actually, a group from China came over to Cornell when I was a student. They claimed to have evacuated twice, I think, for these large cities. Now, of course, with their totalitarian state, that they can tell everyone, okay, get out of here and make it quick, and everyone will listen to them, okay. But when we asked them about their failures, they wouldn't talk about that. They said, have you ever called an evacuation and it was a false alarm? They wouldn't talk about it. Now, as far as scientific earthquake prediction, it seems like the only thing that it seems to work sometimes is strange animal behavior. All right. Some people think that you're going to find ground movement, you know, ground tilt or something like that. That doesn't seem to work. Strange animal behavior seems to be that on the matter of, let's say, hours. Or, in fact, they have an earthquake prediction thing out in California where you're supposed to call up your animals. Your pets behave strangely right before an earthquake. And they're trying to correlate that because the one in China, at least the one they talked about, is that it was in February that snakes started coming out of hibernating, that birds would come and you would walk up to them and they wouldn't fly away. Rabbits, you see rabbits jumping on roofs and houses and stuff like that. You can't figure out what they're doing up there, how they got up there, but strange animal behavior that's, normally these other animals that would run away from you, they just like they stood and froze, and people walked up to them and couldn't figure out why they were.
Well, that one occurred in Lancaster. My family lived close to there, and my mother had three birds, and she did say that they were very skittish before it happened, and while it was happening, they just went bananas. They are normally flying around the house anyway, but then they were banging on the walls, and they really did get weird.
Okay. That, no one seems to know why they...
What they can sense.
Sense, they put up things to try to look at changes in the magnetic field and as far as instruments go.
Maybe they're more sensitive than humans are to the vibrations, and the little preliminary vibrations. Because I heard a story just the other day about a woman who apparently had to... the ability to feel an earthquake, which wasn't apparent to other people. A friend of mine was in the hospital, and they said that there was another woman in there, too, and all of a sudden she says, my bed is shaking.
Mm-hmm.
And she kept insisting on this, and people came in, nurses came in, doctors came in, and they saw that he went over and saw her bed, she's really shaking. He says, well, I'm not crazy here, but you have a paper market, it's not an earthquake, so I'm sure this is the way to here, and there was. So she apparently could feel it, they couldn't. So maybe animals can do that.
That could be. There have been studies on certain people like that, that you put a sensitive seismograph there, the person says, I feel something shaking, sure enough, something on the seismograph now appears, and you feel like, I didn't feel anything, I don't know, that could be, that's one of the mysteries, but that seems to be the only, like I said, it's not always the case. Well, for the small ones are over in a matter of seconds. All right, the large ones, you can feel the rumbling for a minute or so.
So it makes a sudden shift against the flux, and we make more of a sudden shift, and then we'll just be in the...
Well, yeah, for the small ones and the long ones, depending on how far they move, I don't know if I solved all your problems in the verse. Maybe now you know that it's doesn't mean anything, but okay. But at least you know what the data is for you to make the right interpretation for yourself.